I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome back to Radio Times. Catholic cardinals meeting in Rome are set to go into the conclave tomorrow to select a new pope. They met all last week to discuss the qualifications the new leader will need to have to deal with some of the challenges facing the church. And according to articles in the press, there is no obvious frontrunner. American Cardinal Timothy Dolan said last week's discussions focused on church teachings, on schools, families, hospitals, support for priests, and the recruitment of more priests. He even blogged, "You may find it hard to believe, since the word on the street is that all we talk about is corruption in the Vatican, sexual abuse, and money." Do these topics come up? Yes. Do they dominate? No. So today on Radio Times, we talk with some practicing Catholics about the legacy of Pope Benedict and their hopes for the future for their church. Two of them join us here in our Philadelphia studios. William Magis is Dean of St. Joseph's University College of Arts and Sciences, also a professor of theology. And Bill Magis, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks, Marty. Nice to be here.
Nice to have you here. Also with us, Bethany Welch, founding director of the Aquinas Center. That's a new project on the campus of St. Thomas Aquinas Catholic Church in South Philadelphia, 17th and Morris Street. She's a relatively recent convert to Catholicism. And Bethany Welch, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks so much, Marty.
Let me begin with you, Bill, if I could. And how do you think Pope Benedict will be remembered? And I realize it depends on who's doing the remembering. But from your perspective, how will he be remembered in your mind?
I think he'll be remembered as a pope who was very strongly committed to trying to work against forces of secularism. That was part of the goal that he had in mind when he became pope. He's very concerned about what he calls not only secularism, but relativism. And so he's worked very hard in trying to emphasize how faith and reason go together in the Catholic tradition and really emphasizes the objectivity of truth, which really goes against that notion. So I think that'll be part of his legacy.
It sounds very intellectual, what you just described.
And he's a very intellectual pope. I think when people compare him to John Paul II, they see the charisma of John Paul II, and then they see, I think, Benedict as a more bookish, scholarly person who'd be very happy to stay in his study.
Oh, but obviously was a very public figure for 8 years. From your perspective, Bethany, what's his legacy to you?
I think it's very much the Charity and Truth encyclical. And I think, like Bill, it's text, it's words, it's putting into knowledge all the sort of teachings of the church, but in an attempt to make it accessible to folks like myself. But I think it's that idea that truth, love, justice are interrelated, so that there's an interconnectedness to our faith.
Which is also, sort of the basic philosophy and intellectual teachings of the church. That's how it spoke to you.
Exactly.
And is that why you converted to Catholicism?
I came for the headiness of it to start with. I grew up as an evangelical, probably fundamentalist, and non-denominational. So there wasn't a cogent worldview. There wasn't a history of teaching. But it really was the social justice aspect and the incredible hospitality, actually, from the Latino Catholic Church here in Philadelphia that ultimately convinced me that this was the most compelling faith tradition for me.
How about from your perspective, Bill, as a communicator, how do you think Pope Benedict the 16th performed?
I think that in comparison to John Paul II, he didn't perform as well. So I think there have been some very public missteps. So shortly after becoming pope, there was that occasion in Regensburg, Germany, where he quoted a 14th century figure, very critical comments of Islam, which I think don't really reflect his own view and his respect for Islam. But the way that he actually conveyed the message didn't come across that well. I think the other characteristic is that it does come across as really largely intellectual. And so it speaks to a certain large segment, I think, of the Catholic population, but doesn't speak as effectively, I think, to, you might say, the kind of the typical or average Catholic.
I mean, there is PR, it seems to me, you know, in everything that a public leader does, public relations part of it.
Yes.
Do you think he just he resisted that or just wasn't some part of his nature?
I think it's more that it's not a part of his nature. I mean, if you just watch him in crowds, so I had the benefit of actually having an audience with him back in 2007 and watching him work the crowd much more cautious and hesitant as compared to John Paul II, whom I had visited 3 years earlier.
How about from your perspective, the PR part of being a pope?
Yeah, I would agree. I think there's that intellectual nature that doesn't necessarily lend itself to connecting with people outside the library or the study. So I think we have a great value in the writing and the teaching that Benedict brought forth, and certainly is a legacy well beyond the sort of human connection that we think of with JP2.
But there is also, and this is not the elephant in the living room, because I think we have been talking about, as other people have, of course, the priest sex abuse scandals, questions about sort of hierarchy, Vatican hierarchy, political, I won't say shenanigans, but jockeying within the Vatican itself. Are these real issues that the Pope could have done a better job on, do you think?
They're real issues, and I think, once again, it goes back to nature. So I have the sense that Benedict really did not want to be and was not by nature a manager. And so, you know, the Catholic Church is a very huge organization. Right. And, you know, in a sense, the ideal pope matches both kind of a pastoral sense with a management and administrative sense to do both. And that was less of his calling. And so I think that was a challenge for him, just managing what was going on in the Curia.
But do you think he fell down in dealing with the sex abuse scandals?
There, I think, you know, I'd like to see more evidence. I mean, so many people have criticized him for the time when he was in the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, when he should have known or did know about what was going on with regard to sex abuse, and did he act as vigorously as he ought to have. It is clear that he's made himself very available to victims of sex abuse and has actually apologized for it. For some people, that's not sufficient in light of how serious the crimes were.
And sort of questions about, if not cover-up, certainly hierarchical or administrative lack of oversight.
Yes.
And response.
Yes.
Let me get our third guest in on the conversation. Sister Simone Campbell is Executive Director of NETWRC. That's a national Catholic social justice lobby founded by Catholic sisters. Back in 2012, she was instrumental in organizing the Nuns on the Bus tour of the states opposing Congressman Ryan's budget. And her group was also cited, along with the Leadership Conference of Women Religious, for not focusing enough on some of the issues of abortion and same-sex marriage, focusing too much of their work and focus and attention on poverty and economic injustice. And Sister Simone Campbell, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Great to be with you, Marty. Thanks so much for having me.
You're very welcome. And we've been talking with our two guests here in our Philadelphia studios, talking about the legacy of Pope Benedict XVI. And I'd be curious how you see his legacy.
Well, two things strike me. First, his courage in resigning. I think that took a huge amount of courage, for whatever reasons he did it, to go against 600 years of tradition, I think is really edifying. And the second piece is a piece that's less well known about him, but his important social teaching that challenged first world countries to be mindful of those who are left out, to say that globalization and a globalized economy takes a new sense of responsibility on the part of the first world, and that responsibility includes having economic policies that lifts up the whole world, that we're really in this together. And I think that teaching, while not well known, was a critical step forward when he said that you cannot have charity, which we like to talk about in our nation a lot, you cannot have that hand out until you have justice for all. And that was a pretty dramatic statement on his part. So while he may not be well known for it, I think historically he'll be seen as providing an important piece.
Well, and doing some reading for the show, I was also reading, Sister Simone, about some of his comments about trade unions and trade union organizers. Again, perhaps something not as well known as some of the other issues.
Absolutely. Absolutely. The fact that our Catholic social teaching says that all workers have a right to organize, and it's not just to give management trouble, but everybody should be able to use their voice to improve the working situation, the working conditions in any factory or any workplace, and that includes wages, but it also includes other factors. And he really lifted that up as being a key piece in our globalized economy.
Your group and the other group that I mentioned criticized by the Vatican for, quote, radical feminist themes incompatible with the Catholic faith. Are you reconciled to that, or are you going to carry on?
Oh, of course we're going to carry on. I mean, all we do is live the gospel. I mean, that's what we work at. And actually, those comments were more about politics than they were about faith. And so while we could have political differences, if you actually read the gospel, Jesus was forever lifting up the role of women, having women in significant leadership positions. After the resurrection, we know that Jesus appeared first to the women. So I don't know. Culture is the real source of tension at this point. It's not really faith.
But are you talking about women priests?
I would imagine that at some point that could be. The real piece for me is the struggle between a culture of monarchy with the Vatican's structure that comes out of the European model of governance, which was monarchy, and what we know in our country as a culture of democracy. And Vatican II called on us, our reform program called on us to enculturate faith in each of our countries. And when we enculturate faith in a democratic culture, then we value highly the dignity of each individual, including women. And so that with valuing the dignity of each individual, we know the contributions we have to make. It's this cultural challenge right now that we're facing. And so I'm hoping that we will have a new leader who's more oriented to our pluralistic global world and may be able to see the benefits of moving in the direction of affirming everyone's dignity and everyone's contribution.
You couldn't see this, but as you were talking, Sister Simone, both of our guests were nodding quite vigorously. Let me get Bethany Welch in on the conversation. Go ahead, Bethany.
Yeah, I think I'm a post-Vatican II Catholic. Many of the millennial Catholics my age are slightly younger. I grew up in a time where the global church is the church that we know and love and are attracted to, the universal church. So I think, you know, Mass in our language, intercultural masses, I mean, two parishes I've worked with now, you know, trilingual or four language masses happening, you know, simultaneously where all language groups are participating, priests who speak the language of the people. And I think the relevance is what Sister Simone said, which is about our faith. I mean, I think a lot of this dialogue around the Pope and new Pope is political, it's social, it's cultural. But at the end of the day, this is about the Eucharist and about what attracts you to a way of worship and a way of living.
Well, and Bill Magis, interesting that Sister Simone used the word monarchy. And can you expand on that a bit from your perspective?
Sure. So as Sister indicated, I mean, the church really is rooted on a system that came out of the secular world. So it goes back to the Roman Empire. And so when Christianity became the official religion in the Roman Empire, it acquired both the architecture and much of the trappings of the Roman Empire. So kind of the bishop's chair being the emperor's chair, the original churches being laid out in the same structure as the imperial kind of audience hall. And then through the Middle Ages, as I think most people who are familiar with Western Civ know, that the popes became very important political and temporal rulers as well as spiritual rulers, because they had basically the papal states. And that was for, you know, more than a millennium.
And we're almost having a break here. And I guess the question going forward, does that structure work in the 21st century? Let me take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation. That's William Magis, Bill Magis, Dean of St. Joseph's University College of Arts and Science, also a professor of theology at St. Joe's. Also with us, Bethany Welch, founding director of the Aquinas Center here in South Philadelphia. And joining us by telephone, Sister Simone Campbell, executive director of Network. Three Catholics that we are talking to invited to join us today on Radio Times to talk about the legacy of Pope Benedict XVI and their thoughts and hopes and for the future of the church. 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
Delaware Theater Company supports WHYY and presents Love, Loss, and What I Wore, an intimate collection of stories by Nora and Delia Ephron, now through March 17th. A show about matters of the heart and matters of the closet, this show uses clothing, accessories, and the memories they trigger to tell funny and often poignant stories to which all women can relate. Starring Sabrina LaBeouf, Sonia Manzano, Karen Quackenbush, Erica Watson, and Don Wells. 302-594-1100 or DelawareTheater.org.
The budgetary discussions currently taking place in Washington present challenges for people in our community and for WHYY. Yet, at the same time, we have continued to expand our services. I'm Bill Morazzo. Your support to WHYY in the last 5 years has offset government losses, yet resulted in the growth of the services you rely on. A donation today will enable us to continue to fulfill our promise to you. Visit WHYY.org to make a donation.
We've all heard it, forgive and forget. Faith leaders, psychiatrists, they say it's good for your mind and good for your health, but some people are saying forget that. We'll talk with serious-minded people who tell us when it's best to forget about forgiving. That's next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoeng. We are talking about the legacy of Pope Benedict XVI, who resigned as Pope last month. And our cardinals meeting in Rome are going to begin their voting starting tomorrow. And we want to hear from you about what you want from your church. If you are a Catholic, we want to know what you want from your church going forward. If you have left your church, what would bring you back? Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Bill, we were talking about monarchy, modernity. I mean, it seems like that all institutions have to figure out how to hold on to some traditions, but also how to embrace new traditions or even embrace modernity.
I think one of the great gifts of the Second Vatican Council, and we're celebrating the 50th anniversary of the Council, was that it tried to bring together this notion of what you might call monarchy and democracy. They didn't quite use those terms, but they talked on the one hand about the primacy of the Pope, who is still the Pope and actually could take action and make statements without the approval or the endorsement of the bishops. But that gets tempered on the other side by this notion of collegiality, which is also there in Vatican II. And I think that's the way that the church, beginning 50 years ago, tried to find a way to mesh together these two ideas, that yes, there's a leader in the church, and at the end of the day, he gets to make the decision. But those decisions should really be thought through and developed in conjunction with other leaders in the church, and this was primarily the other bishops.
And Sister Simone, do you see those as compatible?
Well, I think I would see it a little bit differently, and maybe it's more that I see the challenge of that position as opposed to, I mean, that was 50 years ago that the initial steps were taken. I also think that there's a way in which, out of a democratic culture, that it's more than just optional to listen to the voice of the people. That when you look at what Jesus said about, you know, bringing everyone together, bring everyone to the table, all are welcome, then I think that it becomes more of a scriptural, for me, it's a scripturally based mandate to know that the truth emerges from the work of the Spirit in the broader community, and that it isn't about the individual, it's about the community. And so I think I put a little more emphasis on the role of the community as being the new leading edge of where we need to go in enculturating faith in our nation. I don't know globally, I just know our national experience, and for me, that's really the important place.
Well, it sounds like you're describing a kind of bottom-up movement, Sister Simone.
I think I am, actually, as you say that, because it really is about, Vatican II said that the church is also the people of God, that's all of us together, and I think that one of the gifts of the U.S. democratic culture is that we bring that knowledge deeply to the issues that we deal with.
Go ahead, Bethany Weld.
Sure. I think for my generation, it's a generation that has often come to its faith through service, through relationship with the material poor. And so I think in looking ahead for a new pope and for a new way of doing church, there's a saying about St. Ignatius. When somebody asked about a leader for the Society of Jesus, he said, "I'd recommend someone who's a mirror and a model." Mm. So the hope being that somebody who mirrors the people and is listening to the voices of the people, but is also someone who has the experience, education, and a clear track record of being inspired by the Holy Spirit.
I'm not a Catholic, so it's always interesting to learn about the church and to learn about some of the traditions. How, though, do you reconcile the kind of poverty, frankly, that all three of you have talked about, and the fact that, you know, there's a papal tailor who is, you know, going to make beautiful robes for the new pope. There's a papal helicopter. Apparently, Benedict was whisked off in a papal helicopter. I've been to the Vatican. It's an extraordinary, you know, piece of geography, I guess, or certainly of landscape there. Bill, I'm looking at you, but Sister Simone, I'd like to hear from you as well. I guess I'm recognizing perhaps I'll put this to you, Sister Simone, because I know you can't stay with us for the full hour, but recognizing all the, frankly, the money that we see on display with this notion of poverty.
I know. It's a strange juxtaposition. There is the scriptural story of Jesus at a meal, and that this woman came and broke this really expensive jar of oil over his feet and anointed him, and the apostles were saying, well, we could have sold that. We could have sold that and made a lot of money and given it to the poor. And Jesus says, there's a time for everything. I think the thing is for us is that it's all things in moderation, not that having beauty is wrong. In fact, I think much of God's creative energy is expressed in beauty, and so if it does reflect the work of God, that's fine, but how do we share it? How do we open it up and welcome people in? It's more about using beauty to bring the story of the good news into our society. Now, I do believe that the king may have gone a bit far, having his own tailor and not being able to buy off-the-rack clothing, but then you have to admit the clothing that they wear is not commonly found in stores these days. It was historically. So as long as we maintain the old tradition, somebody's going to have to make the clothing. But I do believe there is an excess in focusing on that, on the pomp and circumstance, and rather living the simple message of Jesus and how do we welcome everyone in to share the beauty, but also then how do we care for the needs of those who are left out. That's the key.
And Bill, do you want to add to that?
Yeah, I agree in large part with Sister. I think that is really an accurate description of where we've come from. If you look back at the early church, the emphasis is really being with the people and addressing it. And if you look at Jesus from one perspective, to see him really as a religious prophet and a social reformer, but not so much political in the sense that we mean political today. And as the church moved into this realm and basically took over the trappings of the Roman Empire, it became very much involved in politics. And with politics, it meant going toe-to-toe in the Middle Ages with emperors and amassing papal armies, etc. And it moved the church in a direction that was really different from its founding. And today you've got this issue of saying, now that you have all of this, what do you do? And some would say, sell all the artwork of the Vatican and use the money for the poor. Others would argue saying, but it is a legacy and it's a way of maintaining beauty that other people would not see if you gave it to private collectors.
Sister Simone, and we've done as many programs like this, a number of programs about the sex abuse scandal within the church. As you look ahead, and of course we don't know who the next pope is going to be, but how do you advise them to deal with this issue? And as we know, for instance, in Ireland, the reports I read is that many of the Catholic churches are practically empty because people feel so betrayed, frankly.
Absolutely. And that's true in the United States also, maybe not as dramatically. But I think the key is that while we've done the legal things, we have policies in place. We have, some of the dioceses have paid large sums of money. The fact is, what we have not done as a church is to weep together at the sin that was so prevalent. It's not universal, but it is sin, and that we need to find a way to atone, to weep together at the wrong that was done. And if we can weep together, then something new can break open. Walter Brueggemann, who's a scripture scholar, says that the way we form a community that nurtures a prophetic imagination, that lives as Jesus did, is to touch the pain of the world is real, and then that releases hope. The fact is, we have not touched the pain of this and wept together. And so I really hope that there is a new leader who can encourage all of the leadership and all of us Catholics to weep together at this sin that happened and to prevent it going forward. But once we weep, then hope will be released, I believe.
Well, and I do want to actually move a caller up, Susan from Pomona, to say something. But let me give both you, Bethany, and you, Bill, a chance to weigh in on what Sister Simone just said.
Sure. I think the other response around the sexual abuse crisis is this concept of lay accountability and what role the laity has in participating in the life of the church. There's a sense of accountability and an opportunity for us to step up. Again, post-Vatican II, Catholics didn't necessarily grow up in an environment where the priest is infallible. And right. these guys are tired and they need vacations and, no excuse at all for sin and human mistake, but certainly, there's a priesthood of all believers, and the life of the church is our responsibility, too.
Go ahead, Bill.
Amen.
And really, just to agree with what Sister said, because it's more than simply doing what is the legal thing or the appropriate policy issue. It's really a pastoral outreach acknowledging the sin and making sure that there's a real, as Sister said, kind of a weeping for the sin and then mm-hmm. moving forward. I think that's really critical.
Sister Simone, I know you have to leave us, but I do want to get a caller, and this is Susan from Pomona, New Jersey. And Susan, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Oh, thank you so much for having me
sure.
on. I have to tell you, I'm a non-Catholic. I have Quaker roots, but I am a huge fan of Sister Simone. And I love E.J. Dionne's comment that he nominates Sister Simone to be the next pontiff and pope because I think she would make a wonderful one. I think what she does embodies religion, whether you be Jewish, Catholic, Muslim, Buddhist, whatever. She follows in the steps of Christ, and I would hope that the new pope would consult with her and bring her to Rome and have the sisters involved and bring them to the table. Because what they're onto and what they're doing is absolutely beautiful, and I believe rose-colored glasses will help save the world. It's a beautiful thing. So thank you, Sister Simone, for all you're doing.
Susan, thanks for the call. I don't know if you're blushing or not, Sister Simone.
I totally am. Thank you so much. I'm deeply honored. But you know what? This is an honor to do this work that we've been able to do. And part of what we need to see is that because the Vatican censured the Leadership Conference and named our organization Network, the Spirit was able to use that painful experience to create this opportunity for us and our nation to talk in a different way. And so I am just so grateful to the movement of the Spirit that makes this possible. It is gift, even the painful parts of it. So let us hope that for our church, that we also can experience that this, if we embrace the painful part, that the new can emerge.
Well, Sister Simone Campbell, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Nice to have you with us. And again, Executive Director of Network, that's a National Catholic Social Justice Lobby, founded by Catholic Sisters. She was one of the organizers of the Nuns on the Bus tour. Staying with us for the rest of the hour, Bethany Welch, founding director of the Aquinas Center. That's a new project on the campus of St. Thomas Aquinas Catholic Church in South Philadelphia at 17th and Mara Street, a recent, relatively recent convert to Catholicism. Bill Magis, William Magis, Dean of St. Joseph's University College of Arts and Sciences, where he's also a professor of theology. And we want to hear from you about what you want from your church, especially if you are a Catholic, a practicing Catholic, or perhaps one who has left the church and wants to come back and needs a reason. Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. We'll talk about secrecy, Bill Magis. The cardinals will go into the conclave tomorrow. This is in the Sistine Chapel itself, and they will pick a new pope. How does that work? What's going to be happening in the chapel?
So tomorrow before they go into the chapel, they'll celebrate a Mass to prepare themselves for choosing a new pope, and then they will sing this very ancient hymn, Come Holy Spirit. So they're going to be asking for the inspiration of God's Spirit. When they go into the chapel, they will then take an oath of secrecy, as well as an oath to defend the spiritual values of the church if that person is chosen as pope. And then really beyond that, I think a lot of people think that there's politicking going on. That really doesn't happen in the chapel. At that point, it's largely ritual.
That was last week, was the politicking.
Politicking was last week, and then now at meals or when they have coffee, they can talk about how they think things are going. But it's really ritual once they're in the chapel.
And last week, it sounded like there were speeches in support of perhaps people, or certainly talking about ideas, as we heard from the Cardinal from New York. And that was their chance to do perhaps what Congress sometimes does, which is to discuss things.
Yeah, and it's important for people to realize that of the 115 cardinals who are going to vote, they come from around the world and they don't know each other that well. It was just last year that 24 of them were elected as cardinals. So, I mean, they're brand new. And so it's like they need time to get to know each other, saying, what is this person's values? Does this person have the right mix of pastoral care, intellectual ability, as well as management and leadership skills?
But does it matter to you if the next pope is an American, is a European, is from a country in Africa or Asia or Latin America?
I definitely hope there would be some representation from the Global South. That's certainly where the church is growing and is seeing a lot of vibrancy. I would want to say, as far as the sexual abuse scandal, I think one of the challenges we have are some consequences from that. So I don't know that an American pope is where we should be right now. I think there's that idea of kind of getting your house in order, and there's a lot of implications from the way things were handled here, and it reduces the USCCB, you know, our ability to speak truth to power around legislation and politics, I think has been diminished because of the cover up and other political challenges the church has had and how we do business. So, you know, I would hope actually that a new pope would reflect the 1.3 billion of us Catholics out there.
But not an American, from your perspective.
Perhaps not an American at this juncture. I don't know that we've earned that place yet.
That's interesting.
And you look at basically the block of cardinals. So, I mean, it's very interesting that, you know, as Bethany pointed out, 42% of the Catholic world lives in Latin America, but they really only have, about 20% of the cardinals. In Europe, the Catholic population is about 24% of the entire 1.2 billion, but they have 53% of the cardinals, and most of them are from Italy. There are 28 cardinals from Italy.
Meaning that that Europe has, or perhaps even little Italy has a leg up?
They do have a leg up, and I think some would speculate that, namely, Italy would like to get the papacy back. You know, that they had two popes ago was a Polish pope and now a German pope, and, you know, the legacy and the long history of Italians holding the papacy for about 600 years was a pretty strong legacy.
Let me see what looks like Tina from Harleysville has to say. Tina, go ahead. You're on Radio Times. That would be Tina? Yes. Sorry. We moved her up. Tina, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
You're very welcome.
Hello.
Hi there.
I'm a lifelong Catholic. I'm sending my daughter to Catholic school next year for the first time. And I'm looking, I think at this point, for, you know, the leadership to focus more on social justice, acceptance of all people, and possibly more equality for women, more representation for women in the church. I'd like to set an example for my daughter as we, you know, go through this. And I'm looking to see what your guests have to say about the possibilities of those things happening.
And Tina, when you say the acceptance of all people, what do you mean?
Just very recently, I guess, I was in church and get a lot of flyers about threats on marriage and things like that. And I'm a Catholic that also supports, gay marriage and, have friends that are in that position. And I'm wondering if, I'd like to teach my children to be, open-minded and accepting, but also, still raise them in the Catholic Church. And I'm wondering, what the possibility is of leadership.
And Tina, it's a very good question. I'm looking at Bethany Welch here. Bethany, go ahead.
Sure. I think that's going to be one of the big questions for the next pope, and certainly for the 21st century church. These are big questions. These are things that I hope we grapple with a sense of love. And if we say we believe in the dignity of the individual person, I think that's where the conversation has to start, with respect, with love, with charity, with compassion. And it's not going to be resolved easily. I mean, we're looking I think what Bill's talked a lot about is the mechanics of the church and the tradition and the way that things are done. But the conversation has to be people to people and one congregation at a time, grappling with what that means for them.
And Bill, about 30 seconds before our break, go ahead.
There seems to me there's a real tension. So on the one hand, just like what Bethany said, the church clearly affirms the dignity of every individual. So whether the person's heterosexual, homosexual, et cetera, we believe that everyone's made in the image of God. On the other hand, the church has this long tradition of working with the natural law tradition that says certain kinds of behaviors, particularly with regard to sexual matters, are natural and therefore they're designed by God. And so then you get this real tension, affirming the dignity of gays on the one hand, but on the other hand saying that, namely, acting out of that in a sexual matter is morally disordered.
And that's William Magis, again, Dean of St. Joseph's University College of Arts and Science, where he's a professor, or sciences, I should say, a professor of theology. Bethany Welch, founding director of the Aquinas Center. And we are talking with both of them and also with you about what you want. If you are a practicing Catholic or a Catholic that wants to come back to the church, what do you want from your church? 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
Folkways at Gwynedd supports WHYY. Guided by time-honored Quaker values, Folkways is a continuing care retirement community for adults 65 and over. Since 1967, Folkways has been providing its residents with a comprehensive health program and financial stability. Folkways is committed to friendship, caring, and respect as a way of life. For more information or a personal tour, the number is 215-283-7010.
Scientists are creating pigs that can grow organs for human transplant, goats that produce valuable protein-rich milk, and also are altering mouse genes to trace genetic deformities.
There's a mouse that has tusks like an elephant might have.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Emily Anthes about her new book, Frankenstein's Cat, Cuddling Up to Biotech's Brave New Beasts. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Every day we interact with money. We earn it, save it, and spend it. But how we do these things says a lot about the value we place on money and how we feel about it, based on a myriad of personal experiences. On the next Voices in the Family with Dan Gottlieb, our emotional relationship with money, how it began, and where we are now. Today at noon, here on WHYY-FM.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow. Members of the College of Cardinals will meet in the Sistine Chapel tomorrow to begin the process of selecting a new pope. There has been some speculation about who will lead the 1.2 or 1.3 billion members of the Roman Catholic Church, and even more critically, how they will address some of the challenges facing the church. And again, talking with Bill Magis and with Bethany Welch and taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. I do want to get to our callers, Bill, but I also wonder, because you've been talking a lot about tradition, whether this pragmatics is going to force some changes within the church, whether the idea of opening up the priesthood to married priests, for instance, just for practical reasons, because you don't have enough priests to fill the pulpit, so to speak. Do you think that will change the church?
Yeah, some people speculate both about that and women's ordination,
right?
And I would say that, namely, it is more likely that we will have married male priests before we have ordained women. In 1994, Pope John Paul II issued a statement that made it very difficult to move away from this traditional position that bans women from ordination, and so it's going to take some time, if that ever does get changed, to work through that. Mm-hmm. But the church has had married priests before. I mean, it did not become illegal to be a priest and to function in the church until about 1,000 years into the life of the church. And if you think in terms of Scripture, I mean, Peter, who is regarded in Catholic circles as the first pope, that's anachronistic. You know, you read the Gospels and it refers to his mother-in-law.
Right, which tells you he was married. He's married. How do you see this, Bethany? Then we'll get to our
callers. I'm actually very close to a priest in my hometown, Rochester, New York, who is a married priest. He was a pastor in a Protestant tradition, and after he converted, was actually ordained 2 summers ago. So for him, it's something I'm very aware of. He was actually a professor of mine and someone who introduced me to the greats, Augustine and Aquinas, and part of how I came to the intellectual tradition of the church. And I'm very aware of the complexities in his life. He has several children, 6, and a wife, and their involvement in family life and how you manage. He'll never manage a parish on his own. He'll always be an associate or an assistant. But, you know, he's doing liturgies in a way that is very relevant to people. He has quite a number of folks who will come to his masses because they see a humanness. They see a different face to the priesthood. But it's also it's a tough life. I mean, I have many friends who are priests and certainly sisters who've come to that calling to work in the church. And it demands a lot of you. It demands your whole person and your relationships and time. So I think that's also a complexity to consider. You know, on one hand, we want that, and we want that accessibility, and we want to see a face that looks like us. But then on the other hand, I don't know that we're realistic about the time and the really demands on your spirit that shepherding an entire flock requires.
You're nodding your head, Bill.
Yes. No, it's very true. I mean, there's a lot of demands once one has both a family and then responsibility for a congregation, especially if the congregation's large.
Mm. Let me get, it looks like Lisa from Broomall to join us. And Lisa, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
I'm calling because I believe that everything the Catholic Church has to offer is pretty good. I like that there's structure to it. I like that I'm bringing up my children this way. I actually was away from the church for a while. I'm divorced. I'm remarried. I've gotten back with the church again, and I'm raising my younger children who are teenagers in the Catholic doctrine.
And so part of it is what, the structure, the tradition that brought you back, Lisa?
Yes, I would say that, I guess, since I'm remarried and, you know, I guess we're kind of traditional and, you know, we do things and I don't know what to say in a certain way, but
right.
There's a lot of good in in what Catholicism has to give you. And my husband and I were both raised as Catholics, all through Catholic school. And I heard the gentleman, your gentleman guest speak while I was waiting, and he mentioned Latin America and how many Catholics are there. My husband's family's from Latin America, and they are very strict. They are the strict Catholic.
we're all smiling here, Lisa. No, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Bill?
Well, thank you.
Yeah, no, thanks a lot for the call. And here's Lisa, you know.
Yeah, I would go back to a comment I made earlier. I think that Pope Benedict really emphasized kind of the objectivity of truth. And he says one of the most important things for the church to do is to identify the truth and then to proclaim it. And, you know, from a Catholic perspective, that truth is contained in the gospel and that full message. Mm-hmm. And I think that really does appeal to many, many Catholics because there is structure, there's order, there's a particular set of values, et cetera. Some people who are critical of the liberalizing tendencies of Vatican II think that as the Roman Catholic Church became more like other Christian churches, that's what accounts for the fact that there was a decline in numbers, because then people would say, well, what's the difference between being a Catholic mm-hmm. and being a Protestant or an Orthodox Christian? So I do very much recognize what she said, that it rings true for many, many Catholics.
Thanks for the call. I want to quote something from the Pew Forum, which polled a number of Catholics. In your view, what new directions would you like to see the Catholic Church move in? On the top of the list, become more modern, get tougher with abusers and sex abuse, allow priests to marry, become more accepting, more open, generally speaking, accept homosexuality, same-sex marriage, allow women to be priests. But what's so interesting about this list, Bethany, is that in many ways that's in contradiction to where the church stands. So there's an interesting tension, it seems to me, within the American Catholic Church, certainly.
Yeah, definitely within the American Catholic Church. So much of my experience is with people from Latin America or Asia, and particularly if you're material poor, your challenge is around how am I going to put food on the table for breakfast, or how am I going to get accessible education, or how am I going to be paid a just wage? So I think the American Catholic Church that's technologically savvy, that is advanced education and is sophisticated, it's a different consideration.
Yeah.
And so we have to grapple with different questions than the way that the church might speak truth to power around employment or immigration.
What do you think, Bill?
And I guess I would just add in terms of statistics, I mean, the Catholics in the United States, I mean, it's a very large group, but yeah. still in the worldwide church only make up 8% of the total Catholic population. And I think there's a tendency for us American Catholics to kind of focus on saying our issues must be the issues of the entire church. And it's like, well, you know, in Africa, they're dealing with material poverty issues. They're dealing with how do we relate to Islam. So there's a whole set of other issues that are much higher on the list for them as compared to us in the States.
And
yeah,
go ahead. Yeah, I just wanted to go back to that because I do think Sister Simone and one of the callers had talked about the role of women. That is where I do think the church has an opportunity in the Global South to actually be a force for change around the dignity of women, the protection of women, the advancement and education of women. And so whether it's religious orders or lay groups that are helping to open people's eyes to the fact that women are people too. So it can be a force for good. It doesn't necessarily have to be a challenging force.
Let me see what that looks like. Al from Allentown has to say, and Al, go ahead, you're on Radio Times.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for taking my call.
You're very welcome.
I'm a Catholic, went to Catholic school, kindergarten through 12th grade, and it was drilled into our heads that the Pope is infallible. So why didn't he just choose his own successor?
Well, that's in your court there, Bill Magis.
So I think a lot of people think that the Pope is infallible on all issues, and that is not the case. So Vatican I, at the end of the 19th century, restricted the areas in which the Pope could make an infallible statement to what's called faith and morals. So it's basically statements dealing with central doctrines of the church, so belief in Christ, God, a whole variety of those doctrines, and also with regard to moral principles. It doesn't extend to making a choice about who should be bishop, who should be pope. You can't count on the Pope making a prediction about political elections or
who's going to win
or
the next
sport
horse
games.
Race.
The Pope is just as fallible as the next person in those matters.
Al, thanks for the call. Let's see what Brendan from Wilmington, Delaware has to say. And Brendan, go ahead. You are on Radio Times. Yes, there. Go ahead, Brendan.
Hi. I was raised Catholic, but don't practice anymore, but I've sort of tried to follow what's going on. One of the questions I've had is, as an academic, there's an increasing trend in what were traditionally sort of literary, anecdotal areas like sociology and economics towards more and more experimental bearing on how people interpret their discipline. And you had talked earlier about Pope Benedict sort of engaging sort of this longstanding Catholic dialogue between the traditions of the Church and philosophical reasoning. But I was wondering, is there hope in the future to sort of blend this modern undercurrent of evidence gathering in there, or the epistemological barriers to doing it in a faith tradition just too high?
The idea of reconciling the sort of intellectual traditions of the Church and what, more modern ideas, Brendan?
Modern specifically as they concern backing up the sort of philosophical, theological tradition with evidence gathering.
Oh, with evidence gathering. The idea is that you can use science or sociology to underscore some of these intellectual ideas. Have you thought about that, Bill?
I mean, as a general principle, it has been a tradition of the Church, especially strong since the time of Thomas Aquinas, to really talk about the compatibility of faith and reason. And so, in principle, there's no conflict or trouble there. I don't know if this goes directly to your question, but one example from Vatican II in the document on divine revelation, I think the council tried to do this balance between, you know, they asked the question, what's the truth of the Gospels? Is every last word true? And there was a big wrestling in terms of, do we read text literally, or do we draw on what we've learned from literary criticism, historical criticism, etc.? And the council actually came up with a blend and drew the conclusion that, namely, the Gospels communicate truthfully and accurately those truths that God wished revealed for our salvation. So it opens this door to ask the question saying, well, for example, in the Hebrew Scriptures, do I have to believe that the world was created in 6 days literally? Well, the person asks, is that a salvific truth I have to hold to? Maybe I can draw on these other sources of knowledge, science, history, etc., and focus on what the real heart of the message is.
Brendan, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You can call as well. And again, that phone number, 1-888-477-9499. Bethany, you're interesting in that I guess you're a millennial.
Kind of. I'm right on the cusp.
Okay, kind of on the cusp. And also a convert to Catholicism. But speaking, I guess, for all millennials, if you don't mind doing that, do you see generational, if not divides, at least different perspectives within the Church?
Certainly a different perspective. I mentioned earlier in the program about coming to faith through service. And one of the things that we do at the Aquinas Center is host all these alternative spring break trips. So right now I have St. Louis University and Drexel Law School actually is doing an immigration law week with us. And so I think I don't know whether I want to say it's a divide because I don't think it's negative, but it is experiential. In some ways it goes back to the early Church. It's also about community. So I belong to a group that came out of a Jesuit program. It's a small community. We meet house to house once a month. We work with this concept of we believe the love of God is at work, and we ask kind of four guiding questions every month, and we actually ask them to each other throughout the week. But it's house to house, it's family to family, and that really supplements the weekly or for some people daily liturgies. So I think it's experiential, it's hands-on, it's lived experience, it has an emphasis on authenticity. And being in relationship with those at the margins. So wanting to be not only relevant to kind of modern or mainstream culture, but recognizing that we're in this together. And I think Sister Simone really touched on that during her talk.
And Bill, do you see Sister Simone and even in Bethany as part of a tradition within the Church, a tradition that speaks to these social justice issues, these poverty issues?
Oh, definitely. And I think and I agree with Bethany. I mean, it's very strong in terms of the younger population, but it's not simply confined to them. I mean, the Church has had a Catholic social teaching tradition going back to Pope Leo at the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century. And I think both Benedict and John Paul II try to do both things. So in terms of social and political issues, might be called very progressive in terms of dealing with material poverty, peace issues, etc. And in terms of doctrine and morals, being what some might call very conservative.
Let me see what Lisa from Manhattan has to say. And Lisa, go ahead. You are on Radio Times.
Thank you for taking my call.
You're very welcome.
I'm going to be brief, but I wanted to touch on diversity. I was raised Catholic, went to Catholic schools. My mother, Catholic, my father, atheist. But we grew up in a family of diversity, and, you know, my father supported my mother. And in second grade, the nuns were telling me that my father was going to hell because he wasn't Catholic. And I remember spending like four summers at home with him when my mother and sisters would do things to be by his side. He was overweight, and I thought, he's going to have a heart attack. And so I was there to put water, to to baptize him if he so he we would all be together. Mm. Well, that, you know, the diversity in the church is one issue. My father actually did all kinds of work and helped the church free. And my
Lisa, I'm sorry to do that. I just need to jump in only because I'm looking at the clock and you have something interesting and I think and important to say. And I'm going to toss it to Bill Magis. And is the church still tell people they're going to burn in hell, to quote our caller?
Or no,
at their peril, perhaps?
The simple answer is no. And I'll appeal again to Vatican II. I mean, Vatican II and its dogmatic constitution on the church made the point that any person who, so you don't have to be Christian, you don't have to be religious, any person who follows the dictates of his or her moral conscience can be saved.
Mm.
And so, I mean, now from the church's point of view, some might say, oh, great, I don't have to belong to a church tradition. And then there's a follow-up saying, well, but you need to get your conscience formed correctly, and so you need to be in a community that has a certain set of values, which is the values that we're trying to hold forward. But it's pretty clear about that namely, there are possibilities of salvation mm-hmm. for those who are not formally a member of the church.
Bethany, we're almost out of time here, but are you going to be happy no matter who the Pope is? I mean, are you rooting for somebody?
I'm not rooting for someone specific because the reality is in the day-to-day life, in my work and worship and play and relaxation, it happens right here in Philadelphia. It happens, you know, one friend, one fellow worshiper at a time. And so I'm very conscious of what's happening in Rome, but the way that I live my faith at the street level is not always affected by that decision. So hopeful, certainly prayerful, mm-hmm. Prayerful that the Holy Spirit is at work in the gentleman there in the Vatican, and you know, excited to see what happens next and how we, American Catholics and lay folks, can be a part of it.
Well, my thanks to both of you for joining us today on Radio Times. Bethany Welch, founding director of the Aquinas Center, and that's on the campus of St. Thomas Aquinas Catholic Church in South Philadelphia. In fact, at 17th and Morris Street. Thank you very much for joining us today on Radio Times. William Magis, dean of St. Joseph's University College of Arts and Sciences, where he's a professor of theology. Thank you very much as well.
Thank you, Marty.
And also joining us earlier in the hour was Sister Simone Campbell. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times, and you can find out much more about this program. In fact, if you go to our Facebook page, you can see what our guests look like. Emily Bryan helping us out today. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. The show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder. I'm Marty Moscoyne. Thank you so much for joining us.